This is the worst podcast I've ever been on.
These guys are shit. It's true. It's true.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Our traveling fanboys.
Welcome, Place to Be Nation listeners, once again to another episode of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We are coming to you on a frigid August day, September day. What the hell am I talking about? August. I'm living in the past, as usual. We are coming to you on this September day from Hoholoon Plaza, the L-shaped studio, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Ready for the summer to end and to bring in that fall weather, which has not arrived yet.
Well, we have it here in Canada, of course.
Of course we do. My God, that was loud. But yes, we do. And nonetheless, at our home, to go back right after this show's over, it's a blazing 195 degrees, I believe, right now.
Something like that. I think the heat index is actually 228 last I checked.
Oh, my gosh. It's terrible. Anyway, I am Greg Phillips. That voice you just heard was Nick Duke. We are the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation.
You tried to throw me off there, I tried my best
and failed miserably. The lesson is never to try. Now, what are we here to do today? This is an off the page one of the most important adaptations to me that DC Comics has ever done, because I have been calling for this for the better part of 20 years.
You'll learn your lesson.
Of my favorite Batman story, the story responsible for bringing me back into the world of comics after what could have been a permanent exile. And so it is an adaptation called Batman Hush, and it is available digitally. It's available on Blu-ray, DVD, and also on the DC Universe app, which is how I watched it. I would highly recommend it. Now, to review this movie, and for this occasion, we wanted to bring on a friend of the show, the man who is currently alongside Todd Weber running the highly successful DC4U podcast, a man whose love of Batman Hush rivals my own. An old college friend of ours, a man that goes back with me so many years now, almost 20 years now, believe it or not. We're getting close to that mark. And his name is none other than Russell Sellers. Russell, welcome to the Hard Traveling Fanboys again. How are you doing on this fine September Eve?
Shh. Greg, do you know what that sound is? That's the sound of everything you loved back in 2002 and 2003, slowly dying. Because that's what it felt like watching at least the back half of this movie.
Yeah. It felt as
say, not everything. There were aspects. There were moments.
Yeah, this did feel in some ways like DC Comics looking at us all and saying, "Hush, Batman readers, hush." Hush.
You never knew that you needed Rick Grimes to voice the character of Hush and Tommy Elliot. But there it is. I say Tommy Elliot, but we'll get
you
to
mean,
that.
You mean Tom Elliot, my Tom, friend, not Tommy.
Yeah,
Tom Elliot.
Thomas Elliot. What? You know what? That is as inconsequential to our talk as his character is to this movie.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this movie. So before we get cracking on actually playing this movie along with our listeners who may want to watch along, Let's give a little background information on Batman Hush. So this was a based on a classic comic book story. I don't know how you wouldn't have heard of this if you're a comic book fan, but just in case, this was a story in 2002-2003 that was written by longtime Batman scribe Jeff Loeb, who is responsible for such classics as The Long Halloween and Dark Victory, classic Batman writer. And it was the return to mainstream superhero comics for Jim Lee and his first major work with DC on one of its flagship characters on an extended run. Jim Lee, of course, the famous artist of the X-Men in the early 90s, Image Comics co-founder, Wildstorm founder. So this was a huge story for DC. This was the book that actually, if you trace the sales charts, brought Batman to the forefront of DC Comics, and it's never looked back since then. That was that. This made that title the top-selling book for DC, and really in the entire industry during for about a year, and it never really looked back from there. It's been Batman has been the juggernaut, for better or worse, for DC Comics ever since then. And Hush was a story that was built around a mystery, a new mysterious new villain coming to town, and the twists and turns of who this new villain would be. He ends up being a childhood friend of Bruce Wayne named Dr. Thomas Elliott, who ends up resenting Bruce for things that happened in their childhood. And it involves basically every major Batman villain, or most of the big hitters are in this one. And it's just a great story. It's the story that's responsible, if you remember my secret origin, for bringing me back into comics. And I know all three of us have actually read this book many, many times over. Russell, what was your history with Batman Hush, the book?
Well, let's see. Somebody introduced me to this in college. Oh, it was you! Yes, back when it was a two-volume set instead of one. You had both of these volumes, and I was, of course, a big Marvel comics reader at the time. I wasn't really reading anything in DC. And I had just come back to comics after a long absence, thanks to the J. Mal Straczynski run on Amazing Spider-Man. And shortly after you and I met, we got to talking comics, and you told me about getting back into it thanks to Green Lantern Rebirth and this. Or not Rebirth yet. Green Lantern Rebirth will be a little bit later, but this, and I think Jeff Loeb was also going to do Superman Batman.
Superman Batman.
Right around the same time. So yep. You had the hardcover collections of those titles, so I borrowed those from you and immediately pulled into the mythology of DC. I felt like Hush was really kind of a reawakening for me to become a DC fan. Like it pulled me headlong into all of the lore around Batman. So of course I got into that Superman Batman from there, because that was also Jeff Loeb, and it just kind of spiraled out of control from there. And once I discovered Geoff Johns, there was no turning back.
as it is for many of us. Nick, what about you? I know you're a huge Batman fan, but when did you first read Hush? When did that happen for you?
Probably sometime after I came to college, because you got to remember I didn't start reading monthly comics until relatively late into my high school days, and back then I was pretty much only reading Ultimate Universe stuff. And then when I finally discovered my first comic shop there in Enterprise, after I think it was like the day I got back from my senior cruise that I made my first trip over there, I started picking up some other stuff and got into some Batman comics, and then started perusing shelves, just kind of picking up stuff at random. And then it wouldn't have been long after that that I met you guys, Greg first and then Russell. So I don't particularly remember the first time I read it, but I know it would have been somewhere in that 2006 to 2007 time frame probably. And probably I think I just read it at a Barnes & Noble, like just kind of picked it up off the shelf and sat down in the chairs and read it there. But I've read it many times since, and have the trade paperback they put out a couple of years ago that puts it all in one volume. So
yeah.
Big fan, like you guys. Perhaps not as influential to me the way it was to you, obviously, but undoubtedly a Batman story I'm a big fan of. Pretty much anytime you get Jeff Loeb on Batman, it's kind of – it's hard for me to turn down.
Yeah, this is one of the few books to show you the influence on my by reading. This is one of the few books that I own in multiple formats. So same. I own single issues. I own those two trades that Russell was referring to. I own the repackaged one trade, and then I have the Absolute Edition as well. So I have not gotten the Noir Edition yet. No, or did I buy that? I can't remember. I need to get the Noir Edition because I've seen that, and it's beautiful.
It's well worth your money. That is my preferred way to read it now. There's just something about putting that in black and white that it becomes like a whole other story. And I hate to put it that way because the colors.
Are wonderful
on the actual book are tremendous. But then you would think maybe removing such an essential element would take away from it, but it really doesn't. It actually it makes it feel so much like grittier, I guess is the word I would use to describe it, which is fitting since they do call it a noir edition. But it's one of those that makes it feel even more personal, I guess. It feels like it's a more in-your-face kind of story than one that has all the big bombastic colors that come along with the actual story.
Yeah, yeah. And that's one that I've got to add to my collection at some point. If I have it, I just can't remember. I've got all my hardcovers back there. And by back there, I mean I just motioned to something that I just realized nobody can see me motioning to because we're on a podcast. So, nonetheless, let's get cracking on this movie. Long in the waiting adaptation. We'll talk a little bit about where it goes right and where it goes wrong. But folks, what we're going to do is we're going to count you in. In full disclosure, I actually don't have a monitor in front of me at my L-shaped studio desk right now, but the other two do at theirs. And so we're going to count you in. And if you would choose to watch this with us, you are welcome to. We're not going to probably watch the whole movie, but we are going to use it as kind of a, you know, if we see something there that's worth talking about, we'll bring that up. So we're going to start it in 4, 3, 2, 1, play. You know what?
Countdown to kick off.
Why be conventional? You should start with, you know, a four. You don't hear too many four countdowns. Anyway, so.
Has there ever been a wrestler with a four count gimmick? We've had the five count gimmick.
No, there should be. King Kong Bundy's son should have that gimmick.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't hear it.
As good as my dad, but not,
not quite. The only wrestling child that's ever been honest.
Unless it's Randy Orton.
Yeah, true. Or Bret Hart, I guess. But
well, now we weren't
there. So.
We're already off the rails here.
Okay, forget about that. This is a part of DC's. This is actually the 13th installment of DC's animated universe, which started way back with Justice League War in the aftermath of Flashpoint Paradox, and has continued through to, in my opinion, some mixed results. Some highs, some lows along the way. I thought they had a recent resurgence with the death of Superman and Reign of the Superman that kind of, to me, were at a higher level than the previous, than many of the previous animated movie universe films. And so with that announcement that Hush would be a part of this original animated universe came some concerns from longtime fans like me who I've just been wanting the whole time to see an animated adaptation of my favorite Batman story. And with this, I knew they were going to have to change some things because in this animated universe, and there, by the way, folks, there will be spoilers for the Hush story in this if you haven't read the book.
And for the movie as well. I don't feel like we're
talking
about this movie
without diving into spoilers. You can't talk about this movie without that right now, at least the discussion we're going to have. So the book has many twists and turns in it of that nature, but one of those is the teased involvement of Jason Todd, who was dead at the time in the comics. Well, the problem is in this animated universe, there is no Jason Todd. The only two Robins have been Dick Grayson and Damian, both of whom are still with us in the living world. So that's an example of some of the things they would have to change. There were other things continuity related in the original story that we're going to have to change. Batman a little bit more paranoid in the original comic book story than he is in the movie universe at this point. But, you know, I was nervous about this. How are they going to adapt this story? The one thing I never even considered in a million years is that they would fundamentally change the Hush character in such a way as they do. So let's get started on a discussion here about this movie. Obviously, I've been looking forward to it for a long time, but as more information started coming out, guys, it felt like my expectations got lower and lower and lower and lower. And in some ways, I guess that might have helped it a little bit, but it just feels like this movie kind of ultimately, I would say, is a missed opportunity. Not as bad as I feared it would be, but not as good as it should have been. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. It makes sense to me. My thing with these, I hate to go back to this, because theatrically, this isn't nearly as time as I tend to make it out to be on these animated ones, but the runtime is what I went to instantly. I'm going, wait a minute, one part, 72 minutes, which actually this one winds up being about 82, which is a little better, but Hush is a pretty dense story. I believe it was, what, Greg, 11, 12, 13 12, issues, somewhere in that?
Issues.
12 yeah. issues originally published. And for my taste, when you're doing these adaptations, I think about 6 issues is about what you need to be covering in 72 minutes, and to hear that they were going to try and cover double that in this, that already concerned me, because one of the great aspects of Hush as a comic is kind of getting to see that pretty deep dive into the rogues gallery, getting to see a little snippet of pretty much all the major rogues at one point or another. And I instantly knew you weren't going to be able to do that and address many of the other characters that are addressed in the comic. So that was a concern from the jump. And then, as someone who hasn't really been following the shared universe, I think the last thing I watched from the shared universe was Throne of Atlantis. And to say that left bad taste in mouth would be the understatement of the century. Throne of Atlantis is one of my favorite, and well, I'm not a huge Aquaman fan, but Throne of Atlantis is easily my favorite Aquaman story I've ever read, and one of the better Justice League stories I've read. And to see it kind of stripped down and have all the nuance about it torn away the way it was when we reviewed that for Aquamonth last year, this shared universe with me, again, as someone who's not following it closely, that concerned me as well, because all the things you just said, Greg, how can you and I discussed this offline earlier. To me, and everybody has different things about Hush as a comic they can pick out that they enjoy, but for me, my enjoyment of the story rests upon 3 major pillars: the Batman-Catwoman relationship, the facts featuring Tommy Elliott and Bruce Wayne as young men, and Jason Todd stuff. And when you know going in you're not going to get the Jason Todd stuff, and then you start watching it, and it turned out you don't get one of those other things, it's not on a very effective tripod when only one of the 3 legs is working. So, not this is frustrating. Frustrating, to say the least.
Russell, your thoughts?
I would echo all of that. I was pretty hyped coming into this. I wanted this movie to be really good, but as tends to happen in this day and age, I actually had the biggest twist of this movie spoiled for me before I ever saw it. And going in knowing what it was, I thought, okay, well, I've already kind of mentally and emotionally prepared myself for this, like, drastic change to the overall story. Maybe when I see it in context, it will play out differently. It won't, like, rub me the wrong way. And no, it still did. There's a lot going on in this movie, and yet it still feels like it missed the overall point of the Hush
right.
story. The Hush story
right.
was all about a psychological attack on Batman and Bruce Wayne, and it's one that plays out over a really long time. I mean, it is a chess game, and that's something that I really love about the character whenever he's done right, is he's playing a long-form game with Bruce Wayne. It's all about the psychological and emotional torture that he can put him through. Now, that requires a lot of nuance in your storytelling, and that's something that the comic does very well, and that the movie just doesn't even bother with. That is the most frustrating thing about watching this, is that the first half of this movie plays out very similarly to how the comic plays
mm-hmm.
out. You see a lot of the same
yep.
beats happening. There are scenes that are pulled straight off the comic page, and in a
yep.
lot of dialogue that is taken right out of the book. So it's like, okay, well, there.
Sadly, this Bane dialogue that's coming
yeah.
not to.
Oh, God.
This is one of. this is the most eye-rolling part of the first half of the movie. They, of course, replace Killer Croc with Bane because
why?
Because they still don't understand that Bane is supposed to be Batman's equal, and it seems like nobody who adapts him to other media gets that.
They just don't get it. I've never understood it.
Hey, Dark Knight Rises was pretty solid. True. I like
it. So Dark Knight Rises, okay, that's one. Everybody else just doesn't get there.
And what is this lady like?
Lady Shiva was in the original comic, but this is another frustrating thing. Lady Shiva shows up here at the beginning, which is not what really happens, but okay, we wanted to go ahead and bring in the Lazarus Pit thing at the beginning to let that be something that plays in the background. Okay, fair enough. But then that's the last you will see of any of the League of Assassins at all.
Right.
Ra's al Ghul does not appear in the movie, even though the whole Lazarus Pit thing should bring him, like, running angrily from the shadows. And
the Lazarus Pit thing is such a natural method to open the door in Bruce's mind that, oh my god, somebody might have dropped Lazarus Pit. But no, we can't have Jason Todd because of the stupid shared universe.
Yes, because the shared universe doesn't have Jason Todd or Tim Drake, who also has a pivotal scene in the comic that is cut out completely because you can't have it without him there. And that really brings up the biggest issue with this movie is that all of the emotional stakes, all of the psychological battle that goes on between Batman and Hush is based in a longer continuity context. It's based around the idea that Batman has been through so much up to this point in his life that there's so much material there for Hush to play with and to bring up every single one of Batman's failures, because that's how he messes with him. This Batman in this shared movie universe has experienced none of these things.
No failures.
There are no failures for him to be goaded with. And thus, this movie suffers from the exact same problem that we call out Batman v Superman for. All of this stuff that they're trying to make you feel is important is just unearned. None of it works.
Yeah, because in the context of the original story, there had been years, almost really over 10 years at that point, of Batman slowly becoming more and more paranoid as a result of his failures.
Yes.
His failures to protect the people around him, his failures to protect Gotham City. And Tommy Elliott comes in, along with the help of the Riddler, and preys upon all of these insecurities and all of these doubts and all of these fears that Bruce has, and it ends up unraveling his life around him.
You know, it brings up another good point, Greg, about Tommy Elliott being introduced here at the beginning of the movie, because they actually create this opening scene that's not in the comic at all, and they use it to set up the whole relationship between Bruce and Tommy and Bruce and Selina to kind of give you a status quo check. But the problem there is that you're being introduced to an adult Tommy Elliott with an adult Bruce Wayne, and you're being told instead of shown.
Oh, yeah.
It's an exercise in futility whenever you do something like that, because if you're expecting us to make some kind of emotional connection between Bruce and Tommy, them barely having a single conversation where Batman or where Bruce like excuses himself halfway into it to go, you know, save this kid, it's not going to work. But what they could have done is put something back into the movie that they completely cut out. And it's all the flashback scenes that you get in the comic to Bruce and Tommy as kids. And you get to see their relationship for what it was. And you see why they were so like good together, why they were so inseparable. And none of that is in this movie. So whenever we get to one of the inevitable scenes that's supposed to be like a really emotional moment for Batman and for the readers, and in this case, I guess, for the viewers, it lands with a thud. It does not
absolutely
work.
God. Yeah. Here we go. Hush, Batman.
Hush.
Hush.
I think that's his name. I get it.
So I think I'm a little ahead of you because I'm already up to Catwoman saving Bruce in the alley, which is, of course, slightly different from the comic, considering it was Huntress that does this, and Batgirl's about to make her one and only appearance here.
Yeah, what happens to her the rest of the movie?
It's, you know what? Who cares? It's just another.
It's an example of why this movie shouldn't have tried to shoehorn this into 82 minutes. Because, like, we'll talk about the twist and, you know, our feelings on it, I'm sure, later. But watching this, I got the impression that the twist was done largely because they knew they couldn't do the other things they would need to do to make the Hush character as depicted in the comic actually work. So it feels like the twist is a product of the runtime. Because you don't have the real estate for, like you guys were saying, the Flash. You don't have the real estate to build up that Bruce and Tommy relationship the way you do in the comic. And without that, it's going to ring hollow. So they decide to do this other thing, which arguably rings even more hollow. And it's just so frustrating. Another thing I'll say, they've been trying to do this mixing of traditional and computer-generated animation for what feels like 15 years now. And I've yet to see a time where I like it in any of these direct-to-DVD animated movies. Just do traditional animation and be done with it, because every time they go into these mixed effects, it looks cheesy and hokey as hell, for my taste anyway.
I can mostly agree with that. I feel like they've gotten better as they've gone along, but there are times whenever it feels like the backgrounds are just a little too clean, a little too cardboard cutout. This one, I would say, did it better. At least Gotham feels a little like dirty and grimy at times, whereas...
Oh, speaking... what triggered this comment was specifically during the fight scene when they're using the backgrounds that are clearly CGI'd to like wait around the traditional animation, and rather than adding anything to the fight scene, it's just distracting.
It can be that part they have definitely not figured out how to do yet. The death of Superman and Reign of the Superman, it was less distracting to me, mostly because the writing and acting were so good in that. Here, I will say that I like the character animations a lot in this movie. It's one of the few really positive things I can say for it. But the backgrounds are still bugging the hell out of me at times. It's like, okay, it feels a little too like... It's almost like we're watching a movie and all the actors are standing on green screen. So yeah, it really is like watching Batman v Superman.
Well, we're talking about changes, and Russell, both you and I, and Nick, actually, we talked earlier over lunch about this, about the removal of the flashback scenes fundamentally cripples the movie.
Not
in terms
anymore.
Of
like, yeah. At that point, to me, those are such a major foundational piece of what this story is. This is not Hush anymore. This is Hush
and
name.
And it was part of the heart of the story. It added heart to the story.
Yeah.
It's the same way, if you guys remember, in the trade collection,
the heart of Hush has been removed.
There we go. In the trade collection of Superman, Batman, Public Enemies, there was this little short included by Jeff Loeb and Ed McGuinness. Or no, it was Jeff Loeb and Jim Lee that drew it. That was called When Bruce Met Clark.
Yeah.
And it was just this flashback of when they were kids and they happened to have this random meeting with each other that neither one really remembered years later. And it just adds – they add heart and they add context to these characters. And I would argue that particularly this animated universe version of Batman is a character – who could probably use a little injected heart at times, and gets a little bit of it here. We'll talk about that later too. But I wanted to talk about
the flashback also helped to insulate the original story from the criticism that other people have leveled at it of the twist being so obvious and the ultimate reveal of Hush's identity being a disservice to the book. What I feel like the flashbacks do, especially upon reread, is it helps to ensure that there's an emotional impact there even after you know the big reveal, even after you know the ultimate reveal of who is, because it is showing you here are two kids who had such a close bond, who had, you know, very similar circumstances, and yet, you know, it's setting up that juxtaposition between Bruce and Tommy that makes the story work even upon further reflection. And to take that out here, I can't imagine how this one will hold up on rewatch. I would have to think it would hold up even worse than the first time I watched it.
Yeah, it's definitely you're right. It adds, because with the flashbacks, it adds that personal sting when Bruce realizes the betrayal. Even if as a reader you do see it coming, even after you've read it the first time and you know what's going to happen, you feel that sting, that another failure in Bruce's life, another rejection in Bruce's life. So it's this devastating thing. But one of the other pet peeves that I have with comic book adaptations, because I'm one of those people that I'm usually okay if you change the source material for reasons that makes sense. If you do things that wouldn't work in animation or wouldn't work in a live action setting that worked on like a printed page, I'm good with that, especially if it enhances the story or presents the story in a new and fresh way. We talked about that with Under the Red Hood, which is my favorite animated movie from DC, how the changes they made were sensible and actually in many ways improved the source material. What I don't like and what bugs me as a pet peeve, even though it's minor, are changes that don't make sense, changes that are unnecessary. So I'll give you an example. Tommy Elliot becomes Tom Elliot for absolutely no reason except saying we've got to switch things up a little bit.
You know, you've been harping on that since you watched the movie, and I don't even think I noticed it the first time I saw it until you brought it up.
Yeah, he refers to him specifically and only as Tom Elliot the whole time. And that stuck with me because it's such a pet peeve, an unnecessary change.
Stuck with you because you have Rick Grayson on the brain.
And yes, I have Rick Grayson, another unnecessary change that we won't talk about right now. But and then another thing is, like you pointed out, replacing Killer Croc with Bane. Why? There's no reason that you could have just put Killer Croc in that situation, or a character who is at least somewhat similar to Killer Croc.
Wait, was the Suicide Squad movie? I haven't seen it. Was that in this universe?
Yes. But I haven't seen it.
Did that have Killer Croc?
I want to say it did, if I'm remembering.
So maybe the reason, I guess.
But they easily could have taken another dumb character like KG Beast.
I agree. Now, if we had gotten KG Beast, Greg, that wouldn't have ended well for your beloved Nightwing in this film.
Also wouldn't have made a lot of sense.
So, you know, like, they could have gotten any random generic brute character. Hell, introduce Amygdala, for God's sake. I don't care. But that would have made more sense than having Bane kidnap some rich heir to get money from him. I'm sorry, give me my money! Give me my money!
Now, wait a minute.
Money for more juice!
Just turn Bane into Arnold there for a second. And
give me my money for more juice! I got to have more juice with the money! And it drew all because this is not Bane.
It's Amanda Waller here. Like that. This is the frustrating thing with these movies. Sometimes is you know that screen time is at a premium. You know you have limited. You know you have to be economical with your story, and they take these random asides that don't serve the story.
More important to show Amanda Waller picking up Bane than it is to show Bruce and Tom Elliot as children. And I don't understand.
This Amanda Waller scene is where it feels like this is only here to remind you, hey, you've seen this Amanda Waller in other movies before. And then later on, even though I enjoyed the scene, I don't think the Lex Luthor scene adds anything to the movie. Like, I really don't. It's screen time you could have used elsewhere to shout the characters who are actually important to this story.
Yeah, that whole Lex scene in the comic was originally Talia.
Right.
Because you had all the League of Assassins connection. Mm-hmm. And I got why they replaced Talia in that scene, because that we needed somebody there who was running LexCorp. And Talia was actually kind of running LexCorp at the time for very comic book reasons, because Lex was president of the United States, which obviously they haven't done here. But that's another example of a change that ultimately you probably could have just cut it straight out.
Especially if they were going to have that Shiva scene anyway, they could have cut the Lex thing out, because Batman can find stuff out on his own.
He could have hacked into something. I mean,
yeah.
We have, you know, Barbara Gordon here. Obviously, she's not been paralyzed, so Oracle doesn't play a part in the story, where she played a pretty big background role in the original Hush story. But it's just one more frustrating aspect of this movie that feels like it was trying to look like Hush and at times sound like it, but ultimately comes off as a bad impression.
Yeah, and like you said, my favorite parts of the movie, Shock of Shocks, were generally – there are a few exceptions that I don't bring those up. But my favorite parts of the movie were generally the things that were ripped straight from the book, the interactions between Bruce and Clark, the interactions between Bruce and Selina, the some of the encounter with the Joker, I thought was excellent. It was pretty much exactly how I viewed it on the printed page.
The voices of Joker and Harley were right on.
Yes, it was so great to hear Harley sound like herself again.
Yeah, that whole section of the movie was where I felt like, oh, things are starting to really come together here. Like we've taken a lot of scenes straight out of the book, a lot of the dialogue even, and here's the scene with Joker and Harley that's playing out almost exactly as it did in the book. And I was thinking, oh, this is going to be great. This is going to be exactly what I wanted it to be. And then we get to that part with the Joker, seemingly killing Tom Elliott.
Not seemingly, apparently, in this movie.
It was still Hush that killed him. He killed him from a long way away. Like, Joker didn't do it. They still established that. But
in the comic, it's like he fakes his death. And then,
yeah. Mm-hmm. It was supposed to be the big fake-out moment. But, of course, I knew what the twist was whenever I got there, and that Tommy Elliott was actually dead. And then Batman is. But the worst part of it is that Batman still attacks Joker in the same way and is going to strangle him to death, just like he did, or like was going to strangle him to death as he starts to do in the comic. And in the comic, you're getting flashes to all the horrible things that Joker has done over the years, all the bad shit that he's done to Barbara Gordon, the murder of Jason Todd,
Sarah Essen.
Yeah, Sarah Essen. All this horrible stuff that is just like invading Bruce's mind all at once, and you feel that in the story. You feel why he's so angry. He's finally been pushed to the point where he's about to finally kill the Joker, and you don't get a bit of that in this movie. You get nothing like that, because as far as you know, this is the first time he's ever even met Joker in this shared continuity, because guess what? He's never appeared in any of these movies. That's a point of contention with another character in this movie that makes
a much larger point of contention by the time you get to the ending.
Yep. So in Joker's first appearance, I'm supposed to believe that Batman is so angry that he's about to break his all-important moral code.
It feels at times like Batman is a psychopath in this movie.
He is. Like, that's how they're portraying him. Like, they had to go for psychopathy because they couldn't go for paranoia, because we don't have enough history to work with. Hence, this movie is not one that should have been made at this point.
Again, I haven't been following the shared universe. What are the Batman villains that have actually appeared in films then?
Ra's al Ghul.
Talia, Batman and Son.
Yeah. Talia.
Who was Bad Blood?
Court of Owls.
Court of Owls. Yeah. Deathstroke.
Yeah, Deathstroke has been. I don't want to get. I'm not going down that rabbit hole again. That's been about it. And I mean, any other Batman villains that have appeared probably appeared in like the Suicide Squad movie or like as ancillary characters in other places, but never featured.
Just like movies.
Yeah, right. Like you.
And here's the other thing: as much as I've talked about the shared universe holding this back from a plot perspective, I need to take a moment and talk about the shared universe holding this back from a voice acting perspective. Because again, as someone who's not watching all of these, I've heard this Jason O'Mara Batman before, and I think he's had moments before where he's been okay. I do not think this movie is one of them.
I agree.
And Greg and I talked about this offline again earlier, and I think my working theory is, again, a completely uninformed working theory. I would imagine that this Batman film probably has a lot more Bruce Wayne in it than does any of the other prior shared universe films to this point. And unlike Kevin Conroy, who did an excellent job of differentiating between the two personalities, Jason O'Mara sounds the exact same when he's Bruce as he does when he's Batman. And there in moments in this movie where we're supposed to be, you know, seeing Bruce let down his guard a little and actually emote, he comes off wooden as hell at various points throughout the movie, including probably the worst delivery of any line in the movie is right after the Batman Catwoman sex scene when she tells him it was worth the wait, and he says, "I feel the same."
Yeah.
And Greg, that's a good point. It sounded like Hardak from the animated series whenever he said it. Like it was so unbelievably wooden and lacking in emotion. And I understand maybe that was what he was going for. But there's a fine line there that you can walk that he was missing the mark on desperately.
There's a fine line when voice acting Batman, and I understand that it can be difficult, between being cold and distant and being robotic. And I felt like Jason O'Mara in this movie crossed that line into being robotic in time. That one stood out because Catwoman delivers her line, and I want to give credit to the voice actress here, Jennifer Morrison, who is outstanding throughout this movie. She delivers the line very, like, it sounds like someone who is in love. And then Bruce responds with, "I feel the same." Like, and it reminded me of the classic animated series episode where Hardak impersonates Jim Gordon and says, "I'm fine."
I'm fine.
So, yeah, I've been up and down Jason Momoa in these movies. I think he's had movies where he's been good. But in this one, this was probably his worst performance to me that I've heard.
I would agree with that. He is just a big block of wood pretty much through this entire movie. I guess to the animator's credit, they actually have his Batman cowl and face doing a whole lot of emoting, so at least we can get something through that. So I'm actually getting a lot out of this by watching it on mute. I would call out Jennifer Morrison as well. She is a pretty great voice actress, and she carries this movie on her shoulders. So,
100%. She's so good.
One other person that I love every time he's on screen is Sean as Nightwing.
Yep. Thank you.
All of his scenes are great, and for my money, I enjoyed the one Damian scene we get in this movie. I thought that was funny.
Yep. Exactly. It was.
And that one really works for me, but outside of those few, and I guess this version of Alfred we had voiced by James Garrett, he's pretty good, but he doesn't get enough to actually do
it. I hate it so much. I gotta be honest. The voice to me just comes off like this weird mishmash of accents that doesn't make any sense, and it as well is kind of wooden. Like I loathe this Alfred. I guess perhaps I've been spoiled by in recent years by Michael Caine and the like, and looking back at, you know, was Efren Zimbalist who did the voice on the animated series and stuff, but I hated this Alfred. And I know it was a minor role, so I really shouldn't be that big of a deal. But I told Greg earlier, I was like, God, every time he was there, the voice just cringed for me.
Didn't have that effect on me at all. But what did you guys think about, instead of a kryptonite ring, we have kryptonite brass knucks?
I feel about it the same way that I feel about the choice that is made for Hush later in the movie, where it reeks of like early to mid 90s Kuehl in comics, where it's just like, how extreme this is. Isn't this awesome? Like, it doesn't add anything to me.
Yeah, this was just overkill. It only took like the one little piece of kryptonite to do the job.
Yeah, that's how I felt too. I was like, so Bruce says get the jewelry, and his version of jewelry is brass knuckles. Like, that's, you know, I don't know. I don't remember him instructing Alfred to create brass knuckles for him, but nonetheless, it didn't bug me to the degree of some of the things in this movie, but it also was one of those things that didn't really add anything. And again, it adds to Batman's portrayal in this movie as mentally unstable. As like, but beyond what you obviously have to be to dress up like a bat and fight crime, but like, He's a guy who, this is his friend, and he's prepared to beat him with brass knuckles with kryptonite on it. Just like, not just use kryptonite to weaken him, but beat him senseless with it. Very, very odd. And the one thing I did, and we're kind of hinting at it here with our praise for Jennifer Morrison's Catwoman. Let's talk about what does work. Oh, and I also want to shout out to Rebecca Romijn as Lois Lane, who was good again here as she was in the Death and Return of Reign of the Superman. But that whole scene with Batman and Superman I thought was pretty great right out of the comic, complete with Catwoman tossing Lois off the roof.
We even get the follow-up scene, which I always loved in the comic, when Batman and Catwoman have confronted Ivy and like punched her out in some way, and Superman asked if that was really necessary, and both
Batman of them say yes
in unison. I thought that was done really well. So that's one of my favorite scenes.
When we were talking about the wooden nature of Jason O'Mara's acting in this movie, I think that hit me the hardest. It wasn't as bad delivery-wise as the post-sex scene, but the one that hit me the hardest, because it's probably maybe my favorite line in the whole book, was that internal – or that line from Bruce where he said, "The difference between Clark and I is that deep down he's a good person and deep down I'm not." And I don't think that Jason could have delivered that line any worse in this context. It lacks any emotion that I've always imagined it having, or dread that it, or almost like badassery that it's always had in my mind. Here he delivers it so quickly, and in talking to Selena, that A, it kind of comes out of nowhere, and B, it just, like, I don't remember Selena questioning whether he's a good person. You know?
Yeah, nobody asked Bruce. It's like, yes. It's like that internet meme. No one, absolutely no one. You know, deep down, I'm not a good person.
And deep, yeah, it's like, come on, man. Like the delivery was so bad on that. But we're kind of around at it, talking about how good Jennifer Morrison is, Catwoman. By a wide margin, my favorite part of this movie was the Batman Catwoman relationship.
Yeah, it was done real well.
I thought
the only thing that works really in terms of a larger plot, like ongoing perspective.
I told Nick earlier that they should. If this were Fix It or Nix It, my suggestion would be forget Hush and just make a Batman Catwoman movie.
So I think what I just heard say is that you would like to see Tom King's Batman run adapted to film.
Well, the only problem, Russell, is I don't think that they have a 375-minute runtime at their disposal.
Well, they would have needed it for this movie,
No, they
too.
Have enough to do one movie with Dick Grayson getting shot in the head, though, so we can get that one in there.
God. Dick Grayson is awesome in this movie, by the way.
He really is. But that's... It makes me want to see more of their take on Nightwing. Because it seems like every time he's in one of these movies, they actually get that right. And
his relationship with Bruce, like the Dick and Bruce relationship, is like one of my favorites in comics because of that whole father son prodigal son relationship kind of thing. And add that with how and the scenes with Dick and Selena together were awesome.
Those were some of my favorites in the movie. And
yes, he's genuinely excited for Bruce to have a chance at happiness for once, you know?
And, like, Dick and Selena got along really well, which was, you know, a nice bit of change from the comic, because Selena's relationship with the Robins, both current and former, was not really great. The way it was done in this movie, I thought, was kind of a nice, different angle. It's an example of a change to the comic story that actually works. So, Dick Grayson or Nightwing and Catwoman teaming up there in the graveyard, while it winds up being kind of an odd scene action-wise, the parts leading up to it were good.
No.
Here's the Damian scene.
Yeah, really. So Damian pops up on the Batmobile monitor to give his father advice on safe sex, essentially. Really good. So yeah, Damian's great. Really all the family stuff. Damian, Bruce, and Selena's kind of attempt at having some sort of normal home life. And I told Nick earlier, Russell, one of the things they sell in these animated movies is Batman reaction shots to the insanity of things going on around him.
Yes.
And that was the case in this scene with Damian, with Bruce's reaction to Damian's increasingly disturbing lecture.
It's like just
implying
him,
that Catwoman's going to roofie him.
Implying that his own mother, Talia, might have had STDs.
This is good shit. Good shit, pal. Nick, the Catwoman-Batman relationship worked for you as well?
Oh, yeah. It's really the only thing that wound up working in terms of the larger story they're telling here. And again, I think it's because Jennifer Morrison did a great job. Well written. I must admit, the end, like, it just...
Yes.
I guess because we got a little bit more of the relationship in the comic, so I kind of...
Right.
Was able to swallow that ending a little bit better. Perhaps I had just turned on the movie fully by this point, but I didn't dig the breakup scene.
I agree,
well.
and that's what I'm
That one was irritating. That was probably, like, aside from the aside from the twist, that was one of the most just frustrating moments of the movie, and that it's the last thing you see in the film is like, that's where my hands were fully up, like, okay, you have failed.
Yeah, that's a really frustrating thing for me too, because again, take away all the hush crap, take away the stupid graveyard scarecrow thing, take away all that, and just need more time with their relationship and show us why it can't work or why it can work or whatever. Like, it just show us, give us more time with them, and maybe they're both, you know, trying to fight this villain together, and the point of the movie is not that villain. The point is their relationship. But
yeah, you easily could have done that, like done like a Joker and Harley against Batman and Catwoman movie.
Sure.
Where the focus is 95%, you know, Batman and Catwoman just having a relationship. But
So the interesting – and really I probably should end with this instead. I'm going to go ahead and mention this because we're talking about the ending of the movie and the breakup of Batman and Catwoman. So it adds to this weird psychological element to Batman because the movie hints a few times at his unbreakable moral code that, you know, Jim Gordon won't let him break his moral code to kill the Joker. The Joker wants him to break his moral code. He can't allow death in his life. But the way this movie presents the ending of the movie almost makes Batman seem like he's I don't know a way to say it that is appropriate to say, but like almost like he's single-minded. To an unhealthy degree about something, like his brain will not allow him to he's compulsed to try and save the Riddler in this situation, even though this is going to kill him too. So he's got the Riddler hanging on by a string, basically, and Catwoman is telling him, "We got to get out of here. This building is coming down." Like, no, you go. I have to try to save him. There's no chance for him to save the Riddler. The building's going to collapse. And Catwoman says, "Screw this shit," snaps the line. They get out together. And then Bruce looks at it almost like a sad child watching the building burn up and says, "He didn't have to die." And Selina, rightly, says, "Are you fucking nuts? Like, are you crazy? Like, he was a serial killer. B, he manipulated you and destroyed your life. And C, that whole building was coming down and you were going to go down with it. And you still think you had to save him because you have to?" So it creates this like almost interesting psychological element of like, he is really just like, he's messed up. Like, there's no other way around it. But I have no doubt that they have no plans on following that up. And that's not a story that they're implying they're trying to tell. They're just trying to give Selina a reason to not be in their relationship anymore. And frankly, it felt like Selina's realization could not have come at a less sensible time. So the whole ending just does not work. And that is when you add that on top of the other thing that doesn't work, which, you know, we might as well just go ahead and get into it. I can mention that. The fact that Scarecrow is in a hand-to-hand fight scene as being obnoxious, but there's even worse, my friends. So the big twist here is that in the comic book, the Riddler is kind of a behind-the-scenes figure, and one of the big twists is that he's been sort of manipulating this entire situation at the very end. But he's not Hush. In the movie, he is literally Hush. Hush is the Riddler, even though his physique looks nothing like the Riddler throughout the movie. He's the Riddler with bandages on to try and present to people that Clayface – and Clayface is actually impersonating the Riddler, which is a trade-off of the Jason Todd thing from the comic. And the idea is that the Riddler went into the Lazarus pit because he had this inoperable brain tumor that Thomas Elliott could not fix. And when he comes out of the Lazarus pit, suddenly he realizes all the mysteries of his life have been solved, and he knows who Bruce Wayne. That Bruce Wayne is Batman. He also has this gigantic question mark scar on his head from presumed brain surgery.
Because reasons.
Because reasons. And so he decides that he needs to assert himself once and for all and create a new identity for himself. They will use to destroy Batman and prove to everybody that he's an A-lister, not a C-lister. And that leads us to our ultimate conclusion, where the climax of this film, ladies and gentlemen, is a a fist fight featuring Batman and Catwoman against the Riddler.
Yeah. And you know what this reminds me of, Greg?
What's that?
I hate to put it this way because I actually like what I'm about to reference. They did to Hush in this movie what they did to the Mandarin in Iron Man 3.
Yeah, pretty much.
But in Iron Man 3's case, it was actually done for laughs and for a good reason, and here it was done because shoulder shrug.
Yeah, it rendered the character. It rendered the character pointless. Not because the point was not to draw. I don't believe the point in this movie at any point was to get us to laugh or to be like a clever kind of haha. That surprised me in a good way. It was the point here was to throw a red herring out there and surprise, it's the Riddler. And I don't think there's any way they could have pulled that off because he's not the Riddler.
No, they did.
I can't buy him as a physical threat.
The reason they did the whole twist was for people who've read the comic and
right.
already knew that Tommy Elliot was Hush. Sure. So they wanted to try and swerve us. And you know what? Okay, I can get on board with that idea.
Right. Yeah.
But this execution was terrible. Oh, and by the way, I just got to the whole Joker being choked out scene, which if you'll remember in the comic, Jim Gordon stops Batman from killing the Joker by actually firing a shot at him and like grazing one of the ears off of his costume, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And this, instead, we basically get a Batman v Superman Martha moment by Jim Gordon. Gordon saying, Gotham needs you. Don't do this. And that's it. He says the name Gotham. And he's like, oh, I'm snapped out of it. Yeah. I'm good.
I'm all right. I didn't mean to almost kill you, Joker. I meant to almost save you.
Yeah, it's – yeah, and this is the moment – like, I'm finally to the point in the movie where it's going to just spin right on off the rails, and it's not going to recover from here. That whole thing with Riddler being a sudden physical threat to Batman, yeah, that I don't recall that really being an effect of the Lazarus Pit. Like
it's like they conflated the Lazarus Pit with Venom.
Yeah, that's exactly what they did. They're like, okay, well, you know, if they had circled back to Bane in that way and said, oh, Riddler not only like came out of the Lazarus Pit knowing everything, but like he manipulated Bane and also took some of his stash. All right, I'll buy that, I guess. But nope, he's just physically strong now thanks to the Lazarus Pit, because that's a thing that we needed to have happen, because this movie needed a big, you know, knockdown drag out scene at the end.
Yep.
And also we cut out another like big subplot that could have really worked in this movie's favor, because if you've read the Hush story, you know that Two-Face is actually a pretty big part of it, that Harvey Dent plays a huge role in this. Well, Harvey Dent does actually appear in this movie in a montage. That's a
God.
Blink and you'll miss him moment, just to let us know.
Like,
hey,
character design though.
Yeah, character design was good.
Yeah, I liked that. Maybe more of it, but of course it's not there.
Nope, it's just it's a very quick flash and it's done.
And that's another point I was going to make. That montage, I would have liked to have actually seen that in the movie instead of what we got at the end. Give me the Batman and Catwoman fighting crime together. I could see that for a while.
Yeah, it would have worked. It would have been a lot more fun than what we got. And
which is why I still think the twist, at least partially, is tied to the runtime. Like, knew they didn't have the real estate to actually do the story, so they were looking for stuff to cut. And when they decided to cut the flashbacks, they were like, "Well, hell, let's just cut the whole character." Essentially, like, it just, it's so frustrating, so frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, given how useless Tommy Elliot is in this movie, that he could have been just the old generic doctor who helps Bruce Wayne at some point, why did we even
bother? He is only there to be the red herring.
Yeah, that is completely it. And, like, my God, it's if I and Greg and you're a huge Hush fan and you get to the end of this movie, if you're not just, like, seething with anger over that change – you know,
you're a better man than I.
Yeah, maybe you have more patience than we do, but that was my reaction to reading it, spoiler, and then, of course, seeing it on screen. I was like, I'm just as angry by this being the twist as I was when I first found out about it. And multiple watches of this movie have not helped that at all. I'm angry knowing that it's coming.
It's also one of the other things that stood out to me about this is the idea that the Riddler, who is he comes out of the lab, and the idea is that his brain is supercharged, right? He can remember, he solved all these riddles that have haunted him his whole life, and so
in the dialogue at the end of the comic,
absolutely, and I loved it actually. I was like, I was totally good with that, and I was like, here's the problem though. You cannot have the climax of the movie be Batman beating this problem with his fists and his feet and his knees and his elbows. That's not the idea of the Riddler as a character, that Batman has to use his brain to defeat him. That Batman has somebody that challenges his mind. And in this movie, whether it's the Scarecrow, whether it's the Riddler, it's these characters that are given physical traits they don't have in the comics, because it's like the writers, or in this case, the writer Ernie Altbecker, it's like they don't know how to create a conflict between a character that isn't a physical threat and Batman. When in fact, I would argue that most of Batman's greatest foes are not really physical threats to him. Some are, but most are not. They're psychological or mental threats to him.
You know, they walked right up to a better twist in this movie. It's like they were on the cusp of figuring it out, but maybe ran out of time to get this movie done. But instead of killing off Tommy Elliot, I think they should have killed off Riddler. And what I mean is, you kill, like, from the first time you see Riddler, like what I'm seeing right now, we know that this is Clayface impersonating him. I say keep that part. Keep Clayface impersonating Riddler and make it seem like Riddler was the one who was manipulating all of this. But all that was something to throw Batman off, and it was Tommy Elliot all along. So Riddler's one and only appearance in cinematic universe would be, okay, well, he really was a C-lister and we got rid of him. That's fine.
Yep.
And it would have established Hush as something more of a real threat. But as we see,
an A-lister.
Yeah, it would have established so much better. But as we see at the end of this movie, at least it's implied that Riddler's, a.k.a. Hush, falls to his death, falls into a burning vat of something or other. And is incinerated. Like, that's the end of him. And
so, and also the Riddler, who's this supercharged brain, his big plan is to put Catwoman in an easily escapable trap.
And assume it all goes to plan, what?
Yes. like we're out of the 60s Batman TV show, you know?
It really is. Like, this whole thing ultimately becomes it's an exercise in futility. And this version of Hush absolutely becomes Dr. Evil.
Entire master plan. You know,
he might as well spontaneously grow a mustache and start twirling it. It would fit right in with everything else they've done in this movie.
And to your point, Russell, as you were talking about the Riddler falling into the whatever it is he falls into, it removes the ambiguity of the ending of the book, because as you recall, you're not really sure what happened. There's so much ambiguity at the end of Hush, because there's even still a slight question of whether it was really Tommy Elliot. Even at the end of that book, Batman is still not 100% sure. And we don't know where Tommy's body is. We never see the body. And there's that idea that Batman gets that feeling that he's not gone, that he's still out there. And now we've lost that ambiguity because the Riddler has been incinerated by this factory of some kind.
And there's also the idea that Batman still doesn't know who he can trust, because everyone around him was supposed to be a suspect. Like, he was supposed to be, like, paranoid as hell that anyone around him could be this new character of Hush, and that anyone around him could be working with him as well. There's even a point in the comic that establishes this idea in his head that maybe he can't fully trust Cena, that maybe she's a part of this game too, and it would be the ultimate knife in his gut to have established this relationship, only to have that turn out to be the case. It's the final scene of the comic whenever he's telling her how he's frustrated over all this stuff, and she whispers Hush to him, and he flips out on her, like, why would you say that to me? Why would you even utter that word? We can't possibly be together. And thus it's Batman who ends the relationship with Catwoman,
correct,
not the other way around, which is so much more impactful than the way that they do it in this movie by having Catwoman break up with Batman over the fact that he won't kill.
Because ultimately, that's the long-lasting effect of Hush, is all he has done. He succeeded in ruining Batman's life and making him even less trustworthy of others. And that's another thing that I didn't even think about until just now, guys. This movie kind of completely abandons that idea of Bruce investigating individual suspects. If you remember in the comic, he goes to visit Ra's because he thinks Ra's might be behind it. He deals with the Joker because he thinks the Joker might be behind it. He thinks Two-Face might be behind it. He goes through all these potential suspects. And, Nick, I think it goes back to what you were saying also about the runtime. They just didn't have the real estate to fully explore this story the way that it needed to be explored, which I think is part of any great mystery, is exploring the suspects, right?
Yep. I mean, and you really don't have the real estate, again, to go through this kind of the detective aspect of this, where Batman is puzzling over this mystery. There's not that time. And these direct adaptations, you really have if you're trying to do adaptation, there's only so many pages of material you can tackle in 82 minutes,
right?
And 12 issues was far too ambitious, and they started cutting stuff, and what was left on the cutting room floor is a product that is Hush in name only.
And another thing about cutting out some of these subplots is Harvey Dent would have made for a fantastic red herring in this movie, because, as you'll remember, in the Hush story, it's the first time we see him with a fixed face, and supposedly the whole Two-Face persona is gone, and it's just Harvey. But is it? He's a bald guy walking around in a trench coat and has a similar build to Hush. So there's all sorts of pieces going on there, and ultimately Harvey does wind up being part of Hush's overall plan. And you could have used that. It would have been a great subplot for this movie. But as we keep saying, runtime.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, even whenever this story was first published in trade collections, it was split into two separate hardback graphic novels, and they've already shown that they don't have any issues really with adapting longer stories into two-part movies. I mean, they just did it with Death of Superman and the Reign of the Superman. So I don't see why you couldn't have done something similar with this story, since it is so beloved and is one of those that's considered vitally important. And if you're going to tackle these long stories like this, you better start giving yourself some more real estate, because otherwise you're going to start getting these really overly condensed versions that pretty much please no one. I can't imagine anybody watching this and thinking, wow, I really want to see more of that Hush character. That seems really
right.
Cool. I don't see that at all. I don't think this will make anybody a fan in the least, and it certainly doesn't please longtime fans. So I'm left asking, who was this movie for?
I certainly don't know how each of these performed financially or even what Warner Brothers would consider a success in terms of the financials and the sales numbers of these films. But I don't think it's a coincidence that two of their better received projects ever, honestly, are Dark Knight Returns Part 1 and Part 2, and Death of Superman and Reign of the Superman. Stories that are being told in multiple parts to give the stories the real estate they deserve. Two parts makes a lot of sense, and I think Hush is a story that absolutely justified it. Every movie to be two parts? No. But
not
this is one that you could have easily done in two parts.
Remember those two trades that they put out, Russell? I believe the first trade ends with, if I'm remembering correctly, I think the first trade ends with that cliffhanger of Bruce rushes out in the alley, and there's Tom's dead body with the Joker over top of it, saying, "Get the joke." And then it picks up in the next one. And that would have been a great way to end this, where, holy shit, a cliffhanger where we think the Joker has just killed Batman's best friend. Presumably we would have had more time to understand that Batman, that Bruce Wayne and Tommy Elliott were friends if you had
we would have
a whole movie dedicated to it. And you would have had a lot of the Batman and Catwoman stuff fleshed out there, too.
But there again, this is why I say that this movie was made too early, because all of the things that would have made that story work and that we want to see in an adaptation would have to come after Batman has had some monumental failures. And
yes,
that means that we would need to see some other adaptations, like other stories adapted into this shared universe that just happened. And does it mean that you have to do like every single one of them? No, but you could at least put something in there to give this a little more real estate and a little bit more meat on the bone, because it's pretty thin as is.
Or do it out of continuity.
Yeah, like, or do that. Or like adapt it as an out of continuity, maybe even as a direct prequel to Under the Red Hood, which would have made
amazing.
Which would have made all of that work really, really well. And it's also why I really, really hope that after seeing this effort, that if they do actually try something like Sinestro Corps War, that they bring in an actual comic book writer to adapt that, because that's the reason that Superman, the death of Superman, worked so well.
Absolutely. I was going to point that out. We pointed that out on our animated movies countdown, that most, not all, certainly not all, but most of the good DC animated films, if you look at that list of credits, either the script or the story was written by a comic book writer.
Yep.
Whether it be Gail Simone's story idea for Wonder Woman, whether it be J.M. DeMatteis for many of these movies, whether it be Peter Tomasi for many of these movies, Jeff Johns, Judd Winnick, on down the line. This one, and I don't mean to bury this guy, Ernie Altbecker. He did write a pretty good movie with Teen Titans, Judas Contract, but he's not a guy with strong comic book ties. And you're just not going to get the same level of care, at least from what we've seen. You're not going to get the same level of care about these characters and these stories that you would get from somebody like the people that we've mentioned already. Or even, you know, there are plenty of comic book writers that would love the opportunity to write an animated movie. And I think it's a matter of the studio picking up the phone and calling them.
I think they could just keep Peter Tomasi on retainer, because dude is nailing it every time he gets into that writer mode. And if there was anybody out there that I would entrust to write a good Sinestro Corps War adaptation in their shared universe, Tomasi.
Oh, totally. And totally. Well, guys, I think we've kind of explained our thoughts on this one, that it's a missed opportunity. Like, I stand by what I said earlier. Not quite as bad as I feared, because there is some really great stuff in here. But ultimately, it should have been so much better. How would you guys classify this movie? Kind of summing your thoughts up, Russell. I'll start with you.
Well, it tried. And A for effort in trying something with new ideas, because I can appreciate that, trying to adapt something to a different continuity and trying to please everyone. But unfortunately, this movie fell victim to that same old thing that happens to a lot of movies that try something like that, and it winds up pleasing no one. So, as you said, big missed opportunity, but with some really great moments peppered throughout in there. So it's not a complete stinker. It is certainly not the worst of the movies that they've made. That dubious honor, I think, still goes to Batman and Son.
It was really bad. I never finished it, I'll be honest. That's the only one I haven't finished that I started watching. I got 20 minutes into it, and I was like, I just can't. I can't deal with this version of Deathstroke.
Yeah, I can't. I can't watch that movie ever again. It is an unwatchable mess. This is not unwatchable. This is. I would put this kind of in the middle of the pack. It is not great. It is not terrible. But I just can't see myself watching it ever again after this time. So. It's sad to me that this is the fate of my favorite Batman story, but who knows, maybe one day they'll take another swing at
they,
it. I mean,
they redid Death of Superman.
Yeah,
and got it right finally. So
yeah, we got that one done right somewhere down the line. So maybe one day, my boy Hush will get a little bit more respect than this.
Nick, what about you? What is your final takeaway?
Yeah, you can't really call it. It's not as egregiously bad as something like Throne of Atlantis again, which was the last one of these I watched. But it is frustrating is the word I keep going back to, because yep. There are moments where you look at it and you go, hey, there's a nugget of a good idea there. There's an idea that they could have developed more. And it, at the end of the day, it's just a movie that's trying to be – it can't make it what it wants to be. Is it a Hush adaptation? Is it its own original thing? Is it just a straight-up Batman-Catwoman movie? They didn't know what movie they were making. And at the end of the day, it is a confused, jumbled mess of ideas, especially in the back half of the movie. And virtually none of the ideas in the back half of the movie work for me.
Yeah, totally agree. I think for me the big takeaway is disappointment, because it is my favorite Batman story, and you know, maybe we'll get this done again. My concern, frankly, is that I don't feel like this story has been a priority for DC to promote in terms of its other media. They've never really used the Hush character in any of their adapted media except the Arkham games, and so I have my doubts.
Wasn't a very, very bit role.
Right, and I have my doubts as to whether we're going to see this adapted again. I hope we do, but and then my other takeaway is just that I hope that this is not the last we see of the Batman-Catwoman relationship in this shared universe. Hopefully Jason O'Mara can step his game up in the future, because there's something there. They had a good story there. They had a good relationship. Hopefully this is not the end of it for such a stupid ending. Yeah. Anyway,
be careful what you wish for, because if you're gonna continue on with the Batman-Catwoman relationship, I think the Tom King run is a place to mine, and we all know where that could go.
You're not gonna let me live this Rick Grayson thing down, for God's sake.
No.
So before we take a break here, Russell, tell us how we could find you on social media, and tell us what you've got coming up on DC for you.
Well, you can find me at Russell_Sellers on Twitter and Instagram. And, of course, every week up until the end of November, Todd and I are in the midst of our first season of DC4U. This month is all about The Flash. And as people who listened to last week's episode know, Greg, you joined us for that one.
Yes. Yes, Lester Bitt. Morris.
Yep, we talked all things the Scarlet Speedster, our favorite stories, adaptations, favorite versions of Flash and other media, and maybe we finally settled the debate on who is the best Flash between Wally West and Barry Allen. this week we are taking a look at another classic piece of Flash storytelling in The Flash number 123. People will know that as The Flash of Two Worlds, the first media of Barry Allen and Jay Garrick. And the week after that, we're going to take a look at the 1990 Flash series. We're going to look at the pilot episode of that show and how it holds up. And, oh boy, that's a unique situation. You guys are going to want to listen to that one. but, yeah, that'll be the rest of this month on DC4U.
Outstanding, outstanding show. It's gotten a lot of great feedback already. And folks, if you're not subscribed to DC Universe, I would recommend going and subscribing right now. That's how I watch this movie. That's how I'm going to reread Hush, actually. First time. I want to read Hush in as many forms as I can, so I want to read it on my TV. So I'm going to be doing that sometime in the next week. And just to try to wash the taste of this movie out of my mouth a little bit.
Yeah.
But Russell, thank you so much for joining us. As always, we're gonna take a break, and when we come back on the other side, we've got the rundown. We've got I think we might have watching. I can't remember. We will not have reading due to delays in my doomsday clock situation. But we will talk about that on the other side of the break, folks. Hope you stay with us. We'll be right back.
DC for you.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. The Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We hope you enjoyed our off-the-page look at Batman Hush. We are now ready to tell you about all the great shows we have going on at Place to Be Nation, both our wrestling feed and our pop feed. Let's start with pop, shall we? The Hard Traveling Fanboys, that's us, recently did a pretty damn fine episode, audio issues and all, where we welcomed WWE SmackDown referee Jason Ayers, not Jason Aaron, he's not a referee, for a new series called Secret Origins. Jason delves into the similarities between comic books and wrestling and explains the stories and characters that have made him a lifelong comics fan. We then had a countdown of our favorite DC animated pictures, so be sure to check that one out. You like how I refer to them as pictures, Nick, like we're in the 30s? Flash fact. Russell and Todd kick off Flash Month on DC4U. You just heard about this. With guests, me, and the biggest Wally West fan ever, Ben Morse. They talk all about the Scarlet Speedster's best stories, writers, and artists, as well as his multiple appearances in TV and movies. Jennifer Smith invites Nate Milton to watch Jordan Peele's Get Out on the 13th episode of Freak Out Drive-In. A brand new show joins the pop feed as the siblings, Kevin and Mary, host the Brother Sister Rewatch podcast. On episode 15, they bring you The Office Season 3, Episodes 1 and 2. On a brand new Looking Forward, Looking Back, host Andy Atherton is joined by Jennifer Smith, Tim Capel, and Scott Criscolo to preview the upcoming fall and winter movie releases. On this episode of Marvel Age, our favorite Sarcastic Four take a concentrated look at roughly one-third of the most significant of Marvel's output throughout 1972. As a small screen companion to Pop Goes the Movies, enjoy the premiere episode of Pop Goes to the Couch, which will spotlight a current series from the worlds of television or streaming media. On the first edition, the third season of Glow takes the stage with your hosts JT Rosero, Jennifer Smith, and Tim Capel. Speaking of Jennifer, Jenny and Miranda run down the comprehensive list of new and returning TV shows for the fall in the latest Geek and Sassy. They also announce a huge giveaway contest, so be sure to listen and stay tuned to their social media for details. I myself have recently joined the world of Instagram, so I will be tuning in to their giveaway contest. Roger and D'Amato preview the forthcoming, not really forthcoming now, it's already here, NFL season on the latest PTBN Sports Pod. It's This Week in the NFL Week 1. The greatest song of the 80s tournament continues. We are now down to 64 songs. There will be 4 polls a day posted for round 4. You can get in on the action on Facebook by searching PTBN's Greatest Song of the 80s Tournament and liking the page. You can also follow Place to Be Nation on Twitter. Be sure to weigh in. Now, Nick, I understand there's also some stuff going on over at the wrestling feed.
Yeah, PTBN's main event, episode number 132, previewed New Japan's Royal Quest, NXT UK TakeOver, and AEW's All Out, plus took a look at some New Japan Classic match picks. Doing Jennifer Smith, Tim K. Out Show from Chicago, and a PTB Network special. Ben Zani welcomes Dan Scotty, promoter of Pizza Wrestling, on the 21st episode of Row 1 Seat 1. On episode 4 of Extreme Three-Way Dance, JT D'Amato and Jenny continue their ECW adventure with three episodes of Hardcore TV from March 1994. On PlayStation.com, PTBN's tribute to 1994 continues to roll on with lots of great content. Every Wednesday on PlayStation.com, we've got the most interesting and unexpectedly funny stories on the World Wide Web and Glenn's Weekly Walk. For college football fans, Scott Criscolo and Logan Crossland have their weekly Campus Hot Takes, looking back at the previous week and looking ahead to the biggest matchups. Catch their weekly column every Tuesday afternoon. Check out our social media pages and message board at www.bigelow34.prowards.com for information on joining our GWWE, PPV, and TV Match Ever project. Get in on the conversation today and start researching your list.
Nick, I have a campus hot take.
Oh, boy. Yes.
Tennessee sucks.
Isn't it good? They do. It's beautiful. Oh. It is beautiful.
Oh, oh Lord. Oh, eat that Rocky Top. No offense to yes, offense to any of our Rocky Top
listeners. Yes, it's offense. Offense is 100% intended.
Well, it's that time again, folks. Time for that weekly look at news and notes called The Rundown.
Welcome to The Rundown.
Oh, my. So, Nick, we've got our rundown set up here, and the first thing that we've got to talk about is the first teaser clip that has been released from the upcoming movie Birds of Prey, The Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn. And, Nick, did you watch this one yet?
I did. I watched the, what was it, like the Hungarian version?
Yes, that's what I watched originally. Well. Yep.
Yeah, and then I watched the actual real English, or not real, they were both real, but the English version, the version I could understand.
I don't think that I've actually seen the high quality version yet, but I did see the Hungarian version, and I will say I have missed Margot Robbie as Harley Quinn, and did not realize that until this clip came out. I still don't know what the hell the movie's about, but I'm actually okay with that. This actually looked, you can't tell anything by a teaser. Listen, the Suicide Squad trailers looked amazing. I can't stress that enough.
And unlike a lot of teasers, this was actually a teaser. Like, it literally just had a one-off gag that's not going to be in the movie, where they were mocking the It marketing campaign, and then a quick series of images from the movie. So, first look at footage, really, that we've seen. So far, so good, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's too hard to tell. It's hard to tell too much about this from, like you said, but it at least demonstrated a sense of humor, which already puts it a little bit on the right track anyway. So we'll see if that sense of humor continues in the Birds of Prey movie. I am excited to see Margot Robbie come back for this one. Well, speaking of DC, Nick, the Arrowverse is about get ready to cracking again here in October. And as you know, as everybody knows, Crisis on Infinite Earths is the talk of the town right now amongst fans of the Arrowverse. Well, we just got announcements and confirmations this week that Jonathan Shakes, Jonah Hex, will be in the Crisis, as will John Wesley Shipp, although we're not sure 100% if John Wesley Shipp will be playing Jay Garrick, or whether he'll be playing the 1990 TV Flash, or both.
Ah, yeah, both, I think, is a possibility. I would assume, actually, now that I think about it, both is probably right, because we'll have, we assume anyway that Brandon Routh is going to be playing multiple roles, so why not John Wesley Shipp as well?
Really, really cool, and the involvement of Jonah Hex indicates that time travel may be involved, alternate universes certainly, as we would expect. So a lot to be excited here in the Crisis. Coming our way in, what, December when it starts, or November? I can't remember.
I think it starts in the first week of December.
Speaking of things that continue to have our excitement, Disney Plus is carrying forward with the Hawkeye series, and we finally have our Kate Bishop in the form of singer and actress Hailee Steinfeld, perhaps best known for her role in True Grit by the Coen brothers, 2010, I believe. And she will be stepping in and playing Kate Bishop, a slightly older version of Kate Bishop, perhaps, than the comics. But good casting here. She's good.
Yeah, and it makes sense because, you know, these Disney Plus castings, for the most part, aren't just going to appear on a streaming service. They're probably going to make appearances in the films as well. Hailee Steinfeld's got a legit – got a name about her. Legit big screen actor, as we know. Not a TV actor. Oh, those are completely different.
Different businesses.
So we knew we had to get a big screen actor to do
TV
this.
TV acting is what my father watched. Movie acting is what we watch. But yes, no, I'm looking forward to this, Nick. I think this is a good casting choice.
Yeah. I mean, I'm looking forward to all this Disney Plus stuff, man. Especially, again, not comics related, but after that Mandalorian trailer, just seeing the budget and the production expense that is going into these Disney Plus shows, I'm super excited for all the MCU stuff we're going to get.
Hopefully they maintain that level of commitment and quality. Because, I'm excited as well.
I'll tell you.
The other thing that is continuing to add sort of steam behind it is the James Gunn Suicide Squad movie. Well, possibly related to that, we don't know, is a relaunch of the Suicide Squad comic book, which is coming our way from DC Comics in the very near future. And this has got a brand new lineup and a brand new creative team, as Injustice 2 writer Tom Taylor teams with artist Bruno Redondo, what an interesting name, to reunite for a new version of Task Force X in Suicide Squad. Amanda Waller will be replaced with what the publisher describes as an all-new and mysterious leader. And the new core members of the team will be Harley Quinn, Deadshot, and at least for the first issue, as you know, with Suicide Squad, lineups are in flux constantly. But at least in the first issue, Harley and Deadshot will be joined by the Shark, Zebra Man, the Cavalier, famous Batman Z-list villain, the Cavalier, and Magpie. Are you ready for the rejuvenation of Magpie, Nick?
I think so, for sure.
Magpie's most famous exposure, it was in the John Byrne Man of Steel miniseries in the 80s. But she also was brought up in the excellent Superman Batman story that we were referencing earlier, Public Enemies, as Bruce and Clark are actually actively making fun of what a lame villain she is. So that's pretty good stuff. And then, I guess to wrap things up on the rundown this week, we got to do it. We're contractually obligated to talk about any wrestling and comics crossover. And we got another one, Nick. Are you ready for this?
We do. I am.
Well, 2000s era WWE wrestlers, I'm going to put on my best JR voice here, Mohamed Hassan and Shad Gaspard are joining the comic book industry with a creator-owned series titled Assassin and Son, Path of Vengeance. Working under their real names, Mark Capone and Shad Gaspard, the two wrestlers are working with artist Eater Messiah. What an interesting name. And this is being published by Scout Comics. So it looks like it's going to debut next spring, and hey, man, the more wrestlers that can find success outside the business, the better. I hope this does really well for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I probably won't read it, but still kind of cool to see that there is a big crossover between our two loves and that some guys who used to be in one business are trying to break
absolutely
into another.
Flexing their creative muscles. So really cool stuff there. Now, that's pretty much it for the rundown. I got nothing else, Nick. Do you have anything else for the people's ear holes, news related?
I do not.
Well, then let's move on to – I don't even know if we're going to have this segment, Nick. I really don't. I mean, are we even going to have a reading and watching?
Let's just not bother.
There's no need to. I haven't read anything. I bought Doomsday Clock, but there was a delay on it because of – behind the scenes drama with my comic book shops, and so I haven't read it yet. Plus, football took up my weekend, so yes. And I haven't played anything comic book related. And
nope,
I already talked last week about watching the Supergirl finale, and I haven't watched anything since then other than Batman Hush, unfortunately. So. With that being said, I guess as I turn around and I look at the sands through the hourglass, you know, which usually represents the beginning of Days of Our Lives, but in this case it represents the wrestling minute. Now, Nick,
I don't know how much I can add here, as I've fallen asleep during two consecutive episodes of Monday Night Raw, so. You know,
you're getting here old, we are. Friend. This past week's Raw, I've only watched about half of it because I was recording a little bit inside baseball here. I was recording another podcast last night when Raw came on, and so I haven't actually watched the whole show yet. I was.
That's more podcasts.
I didn't hear a word you just said.
I said that's what we all need in our lives is more podcast that's recordings. Right.
And I've gotten about halfway through Raw, and it was sure was great to see old Stone Cold come back and. Drop a stunner or two. That was fun. And
it was. Makes me wish you could work with AJ in longer form, but I know it can't
happen. It should happen, though. Maybe in our dreams. It
should.
But no, the that was awesome. AJ was really funny in that segment, you know, being the southern heel that thinks he's great and thinks he's hilarious and laughs at his own jokes. And then... you know, just a few segments after that, we got a good one segment after that, we got a good Cedric and AJ match. I like that. And then a tremendous tag match with the Four Horsewomen. That was actually what I watched right before we did the show, was the Four Horsewomen tag match, Becky and Charlotte versus as wacky tag partners who hate each other versus Becky and or versus Sasha and Bayley. Excellent match. Had the whole crowd rocking. This is awesome chance, etc. Really cool sequences in there. Enjoyed the hell out of it. So I'm hoping the rest of Raw can live up to that. But that was all good stuff, man.
There you go.
Nick, are you planning on catching the AE dub in Nashville?
No.
Fair enough. When are you going to check out the AE dub?
live, you
Certainly.
Mean? Certainly. When they make it to Atlanta or a little closer, I just made that Nashville drive. That's a good 6-hour drive from my place. And in the middle of football season, just not feasible. I'm going to wait for a little bit closer because inevitably they're going to do an Atlanta show. And I imagine it'll be a really big deal when they do one, given the somewhat spiritual ties they have to WCW.
Absolutely. And Nick, I got to ask you, you kicked off another football weekend this past week, enjoyed a little bit of that, that Georgia Bulldogs action. I have to ask you this. Did you enjoy a little bit of the bubbly?
I did not have any of the bubbly. None of the bubbly. I had some vodka. I had some whiskey. What? And I had some beer. But no.
What?
No bubbly.
Next
weekend, all the bubbly will be consumed.
A little bit
of
the bubbly. Well, that's excellent information, sir. And I'm glad to hear it. I'm glad to hear that you're refraining from the bubbly for now. We will nonetheless talk about that again at another time on the Wrestling Minute. Well, with that being said, another day, another dollar at the Place to Be Nation hard traveling headquarters. We hope you've enjoyed your stay at our resort. And before we go, I understand, Nick, that we've got one more segment.
We do. You know, Greg, we're going to end our show the same way we have been for months now, with WWE Hall of Famer Jim Ross coming in to perform our exit music. And, you know, it can never be said that the hard-traveling fanboys don't have their thumb firmly on the pulse of pop culture. So I thought, what better way to lead us out today than by having JR do a song that topped the charts weeks ago and is no longer at the top of the charts? Just to prove to you how on top of things we are. So JR, got this interesting song here for you. I don't know if you're aware of it, but I'm interested to see how you handle this.
Well, quite frankly, Conrad, this is the first time that I'm actually looking at the lyrics. And what was that?
Nothing. Nothing. I'm not Conrad, but thank you. All right,
then. All right. Who the hell are you? I don't understand. Anyway, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to read these lyrics to what I assume the tune might be. So,
Western.
Oh, yeah! I'm going to take my horse to the old town road. I'm going to ride until I can't no more. I'm going to take my horse to the old town road. I'm going to ride till I can't no more. I have got the horses in the back. Horse tack is attack. Hat is matte black. Got the boots that's black to match. Riding on a horse. You can whip your Porsche. I've been in the valley. You ain't been up off that porch now. Can't nobody tell me nothing.
You can't tell me nothing.
Can't nobody tell me nothing.
You can't get on your little Twitter and tell me nothing about this business.
Now, this is something that's real near dear to my heart, folks. Riding on a tractor, lean on my bladder. Cheated on my baby. You can go and ask her at. My life is a movie. Bull riding and booby. Black Resistol hat from Gucci. Wrangler on my booty.
Oh, yeah.
Can't nobody tell my ass nothing. You can't tell me nothing. Ain't nobody gonna tell my ass nothing. You can't tell my ass nothing about this.
Yes.
I am going to take my horse to the old town road. I'm going to ride until I can't ride no more. I'm going to take my horse to the old town road. And you know what? Damn the mules, just load the wagon.
Hat down, cross town, living like a rock star. Spend a lot of money on my brand new guitar.
Baby's got a habit.
Diamond rings and Fendi sports bras with that cocaine on the side.
Riding down rodeo in my Maserati sports car. Not unlike the one that, well, never mind. Got no stress. I've been through all that. I am like a Marlboro man. You know, Harley liked them. So I kick on back. Wish I could roll on back that old town road to Norman, Oklahoma. I want to ride till I can't ride no more. Yeah, I am going to take my ass to the old town road. I'm going to ride it with Lincoln Riley till I can't no more. I'm going to take old Jalen Hurts out there, too, to the old town road. We are going to ride all the way to a championship victory.
Our traveling fanboys.